now. He looked like a lion tamer in a movie. "Come on, you bastard!" his father yelled at the dog. Adam had never heard his father swear like that before, although he said hell and damn once in a while. The sound coming from the dog was not a growl anymore, but a kind of cry, a moan, as if it had been injured. And then, as suddenly as it had appeared, it departed, pawing the ground one moment and then turning away the next, thrashing through bushes and thicket. Adam's father turned, mouth open, breath coming in huge gasps, his cheeks streaked with dirt and sweat, jacket torn. Adam rushed to him, flung his arms around him. He had never loved his father as much as at that moment.
And that was the clue?
I think so. You said to tell it all from the beginning, if possible. And this was the beginning.
What strikes you as important about that incident?
What do you mean?
I mean, was the encounter with the dog in the woods most important, or was it what made you and your father enter the woods? 5-second interval.
At the time, my father and I didn't talk about why we went into the woods. We didn't say anything to my mother. It was as if we shared a secret. And the dog was such a terrifying experience that it overshadowed everything else. I hadn't seen anyone following us. My father told my mother that he had felt like taking a walk in the woods because it was the first nice day in March. And by the time it was all over, they found the dog had actually bitten my father and he needed a shot at the hospital, I'd forgotten about the reason why we went into the woods.
What do you think your father saw on the street that made him panic?
I don't know. Even now, I'm sure he did panic. I'm telling it the way I remembered, but that was a long time ago. I was only 9.
But you felt at the time that your father was in flight through the woods?
Yes.
What do you suppose he saw?
I don't know. I don't know.
5-second interval.
May we take a break? I'm tired. Drained.
Of course. You did well. Try to rest now.
Thank you.
End tape OZK-004.
The telephone booth stands outside Howard Johnson's, at the junction of Route 99 and 119, and the sun splashes on the windows and glass doors of the booth. I get off my bike and walk toward the booth. My shoe rubs against a blister on the heel of my right foot. I bend against the wind and start to search for change in my pocket. I need to talk to Amy Hertz. Her voice will sustain me. I should have called her this morning before I left Monument. I should have taken the medicine. I should have stopped in Fairfield and gone to the John, or at least bought something to eat, even if it was only a Hershey bar. Now I am somewhere between Fairfield and Carver, and there are all those other places ahead to go through, and I'm discouraged. I get discouraged very easily. That's why I need to talk to Amy. She refreshes my spirit. She makes me laugh. I love her. I reach the telephone booth after an endless walk, like in a dream when you can't reach your destination, and I look at my watch and find out that it's only 1:15. School doesn't end until 2:15, and it takes her at least 15 minutes to get home if she doesn't stop on the way. I look at the telephone in the booth with disgust. Not disgust for the phone, but disgust at myself. I've lost all track of time. I will never reach Belton Falls by darkness at this rate, and I have to go to the John. I glance at Howard Johnson's. I'm not hungry, but I know that my body requires food for energy, fuel for my trip to Rutterburg. My mother always says that I don't eat enough, and she's always trying to get food into me or bringing home the latest vitamin discovery in the form of candy or chewing gum. My poor mother. I walk my bike to the door of Howard Johnson's. When I was just a little kid, I called it Orange Johnson, and we were driving along in the car, my mother and father and me. I was between them in the front seat, and when I said Orange Johnson for the first time, they laughed and laughed, and I felt safe and secure and surrounded by love. And sometimes in the night, even now, I murmur, Orange Johnson, in the dark, and feel good again, safe again. I really have to go to the John now. I know Howard Johnson's has restrooms, but there are at least two problems. First of all, what can I do with the bike? There is no lock, and I can't risk leaving it unguarded, because somebody might steal it and I would be marooned here if that happened. The second problem is this. Suppose the bathroom in Howard Johnson's has no window. That will create all kinds of complications because I can't stand places without windows. Then I see an immediate solution to the bike problem. The booths are located near the windows, and I will sit in a booth close to the door and be able to keep an eye on the bike. The second problem is also quickly solved, and I figure that my luck is turning. From my vantage point, I can see a Sunoco station across the street, and the restroom sign is visible, and there is a window in the door of the one that says men. Now that relief is imminent, I really have to go to the John, and I hurry across the street. Later, I stand in the telephone booth, and the telephone rings and rings. I know it's a long shot. I know that Amy Hertz is still in school, but I figure that maybe she came home early. But the phone keeps on ringing, and I lose count of the rings. My stomach is tight and tense. The hamburger I ate in Howard Johnson's has turned into a rock in my stomach. I should have ordered something easy to digest, soup or chowder, and I should have taken the medicine with me. My hand is glued with perspiration to the receiver, and my fingers feel strange and alien. They are accustomed to the contours of the bike's handlebars. A headache has begun, iron bars beneath the flesh of my forehead. I'm a wreck, but Amy Hertz, even the voice of Amy Hertz, could cure all that. The phone is still ringing, unendingly. The trucks are headed north on Interstate 99, and their motors grind and groan. Lonesome sounds. The operator cuts in. I'm sorry, your party does not answer. The operator is a man, and it's startling to hear a man's voice on the line. Will you try a few more times, I ask, although I know it's futile. Yet, somehow, I find it comforting to know that the phone is ringing in Amy's home, echoing in the rooms where she eats and sleeps and reads her books and watches television. After a while, the operator says, I'm sorry, sir. There is still no answer. Thank you, I say. Thank you for trying. Immediately, the coins come tumbling out of the phone, and I slip them out of the coin return slot. I push open the door of the booth. It sticks for a minute, and my heart pounds. Will I be trapped inside? But it finally opens again, and I step outside. The sun has disappeared, and the clouds are low, pressing downward, almost claustrophobic. Rutterberg seems far away, impossible to reach. My stomach lurches with nausea, and my head throbs. I walk toward the bike, and my blister hurts. If I could have talked with Amy. My next stop is Carver, and I check my map. The mileage chart says that 1 inch represents 10 miles, and Carver is only about 1/2 inch away. By the time I reach Carver, Amy should be home from school. And maybe I can find a drugstore in Carver and buy aspirins for my headache. I check the bike, and I lash my father's present to the basket. I pull the cap down over my ears. It keeps me warm and shuts out the lonesome sounds of the trucks laboring up the hill on Interstate 99. I look behind, but nobody is following me. In Carver, I can probably find a restaurant and order some soup or chowder. I get on the bike and tell my legs, pedal, pedal. It's as if I have been pedaling forever. I sing to keep up my spirits. The farmer in the dell, the farmer in the dell. But I only sing for a little while, because I am tired, and I just want to hold on until I reach Carver.
Tape OZK 005-1350, date deleted TA. Shall we discuss Amy Hertz?
If you want to.
5-second interval. Would you describe her as your best friend? Or more?
More. He thought of the night he and Amy had huddled together under the football stands, the field deserted, winter winds blowing, and how their lips had touched and opened, her tongue darting swiftly, seeking his and then touching, and he shivered, not with the cold, but with delight. He had felt her breasts against his chest, and his breath came rapidly, his heart beating dangerously. God, how he loved her.
More than a friend.
Tell me about her.
Amy. Amy Hertz, who loved mischief and was always on the prowl for mischief. Amy said that everybody took life too seriously. When he first met her, she said,
"Now what's the matter with you, Ace? You don't laugh enough. You have this long look on your face. But there's hope, Ace, there's hope. I see the possibility of laughter in your baby blues."
She talked like that. Wise guy talk. But she had her serious moments. She could isolate herself with books for hours at a time. And that's how they met, the books. She was going into the Monument Public Library, and he was coming out, and they collided at the door. The books they held in their arms spilled all over the place. As they bent to retrieve them, Amy said,
"Know what this reminds me of? This reminds me of those old Hollywood comedies you see on TV, where the hero and the heroine meet ridiculously. I mean, you can picture the writers sitting around the studio saying, 'Well, how do they meet this time?' And somebody says, 'I've got it. How about she's going into the library with all these books, and he's coming out with all these books?'"
They were on their knees at the library's entrance with people coming and going, stepping around them. And she was talking a mile a minute, and he was wondering, who was this crazy girl anyway? By the time they had gathered their books, "Don't mix yours up with mine," she said. "It'll cost you a mint, because mine are all a month overdue at least." Anyway, by the time they stood facing each other, out of breath somehow, he was madly in love with her. She told him that her name was Amy Hertz. "No car rental jokes, please." She was short and robust and freckled, and one of her front teeth was crooked, but her eyes were beautiful, blue, like the blue of his mother's best china. She also had wonderful breasts. She told him later that her breasts were an embarrassment to her, too large. "Try lugging these things all over town every day." But he was in love with her before he even noticed them. He also loved her because she didn't laugh when he told her that someday he was going to be a famous writer like Thomas Wolfe. And he loved her even more when she didn't ask who Thomas Wolfe was, or didn't confuse him with the hip writer Tom Wolfe. Later, of course, she confessed that she hadn't the slightest idea who Thomas Wolfe was.
"You look like a great candidate for the number," Amy said that first day, appraising him through squinted eyes.
She was farsighted, but hated wearing glasses.
"Shy, maybe, but I think you're the type who doesn't lose his cool, and cool is needed for the number."
"What's the number?" he asked, bewildered and delighted at the same time, having never met anyone like Amy Hertz before.
"You'll find out, Ace.
Tomorrow, after school. Meet me at the front door. If you're available, that is." He literally spun out of the library, books clutched in his arms, taking a moment to watch through the window as Amy Hertz proceeded to the circulation desk to return her books. He felt exuberant, wanting to burst into song, his usual shyness gone. He wanted to speak to complete strangers and tell them what a marvelous day this was, how beautiful the sunshine was as it poured forth on Main Street, dazzling in its brightness, turning the world golden. The next day, he was waiting for her when she emerged from the school.
"Glad to see you, Ace," she said,
and he was swept along in her wake as she prattled on about school and classes and a terrible test in algebra that she was certain she had failed. She stopped abruptly and turned toward him.
"You're a shy one, aren't you? And you don't say much.
Or is it because I haven't given you a chance?"
Her eyes were blue flowers.
"I'm shy," he said, marveling how he really didn't feel shy in her presence. Ordinarily, he shunned strangers. His marks often suffered in school because, although he did well in written tests and compositions, he was terrible in oral recitations, speeches, anything that required the spotlight of attention to be focused on him.
"How come I've never seen you around?"
she asked as they walked along. He shrugged. "I don't know." But he did know, of course. He was seldom around. He usually went straight home after school. His mother was home, waiting for him, withdrawn in her room, upset if he arrived a few minutes late, tense and nervous if she didn't always know his whereabouts. He sometimes wondered what had happened to transform his mother from the laughing, tender woman to whom the scent of lilac clung into the pale, subdued, and antiseptic woman who seldom left the house, who lurked behind window curtains. Adam could feel her eyes following him when he left the house. But he didn't want to tell Amy Hertz about his mother. He'd feel like a traitor to her. Anyway, his terrible shyness, his inability to feel at ease with people, had nothing to do with his mother. He felt it was his basic character. He preferred reading a book or listening to old jazz records in his bedroom to going to dances or hanging around downtown with the other kids. Even in the fourth or fifth grade, he had stayed on the outskirts of the schoolyard, watching the other kids playing the games. Kick the can was a big thing in the fourth grade. Anyway, he had never felt left out. It was his choice. To be a witness, to observe, to let the events be recorded within himself on some personal film in some secret compartment no one knew about except him. It was only later, in the eighth grade, when he knew irrevocably that he wanted to be a writer, that he realized he had stored up all his observations, all his emotions, for that purpose. How could he possibly tell Amy Hertz all this without sounding like some kind of a nut? Yet the funny thing, the strange thing, was that he wanted to tell her. They arrived at Amy's house, and he waited while she changed into jeans. Amy's mother, a tall, thin woman, acknowledged her introduction to Adam without really looking at him. She was on the telephone, making arrangements for a committee meeting of some sort, and then she dashed out of the house on the way to another committee meeting. Adam wondered whether he should call his mother. He had told her he'd be late today, detained at a meeting of the literary club, but he was a terrible liar, and guilt assailed him now. He wondered whether he had made a mistake meeting Amy Hertz after school like this. What did a girl like her want with someone like him? She was lightning. He was cloud, gray cloud. He sensed a poem lurking in the words and wanted to scribble them down. "I'll be right out," Amy called, distracting him. He decided not to call his mother. Amy was in the bathroom, and Adam wandered in that direction, summoned by her voice. He could hear all the noises she made in there, and he tried not to listen, his cheeks warm. He heard the sound of a toilet flushing and the water faucet running. Amy stepped out and saw the blood staining his cheeks. Amused, she said, "Look, Ace, don't let a few farts bother you. It's all part of nature and being alive." Later, she told him that she had chosen the words deliberately. "A bit of shock therapy," she explained. They made their way to the A&P and the number. The basic idea of the number was simple. To fill a shopping cart with as many items as possible, and then abandon it somewhere in the store and leave the store without being detected. Amy, however, had gone far beyond this basic premise. She had concocted all kinds of variations. First of all, the conditions were different at various times of the week. For instance, a Tuesday afternoon was a serious challenge, because there were few shoppers around, and it was easy for store personnel to spot any suspicious actions. Thursday nights and Saturdays were busy times, but Amy also increased the risks. She'd insist that only canned goods could be loaded into the cart, or another time, only jars, and she'd rule out gallon jugs. Once, she loaded an entire shopping cart with baby food. It must have contained 500 jars. She abandoned it in front of the Kotex display. God, but Amy Hertz was beautiful to watch when she was doing a number. The process had to be carried out seriously, with no hint of mischief. Sometimes she'd carry a shopping list, a real list that they'd jot down at her house after school. She'd consult the list frequently as they shopped, frowning over brand names, muttering about prices. One time, she and Adam took along a little kid, a neighbor of hers, to give the number a family countenance. Amy said the important thing was to act natural, as if they belonged there, and always to act a little angry, a little impatient, because that always intimidated people. Sometimes she'd even ask a clerk for assistance. "Hey, where are the sardines anyway?" she'd demand, annoyed at the store for hiding the sardines somewhere. That Amy. Amy was at her best on those busy Thursday nights. She would attempt to fill as many shopping carts as possible. "Listen," she told Adam, "with your help we can break all existing records." They proceeded to do just that. They established the record one Thursday night during a big anniversary sale. Working individually, they filled 12 carts, 8 for Amy and 4 for Adam. The carts were piled dangerously high, and Amy topped each one of them with a bunch of celery, like some grotesque centerpiece. They had abandoned the carts all over the store, and were delighted when a clerk went by, glanced at a cart, looked puzzled, and then continued on his way. But Amy wasn't content to end it all so casually. She insisted that all the carts be brought together in the last aisle where the fruits and vegetables were displayed. They lined them up like soldiers at attention. "Don't rush. Act nonchalant," Amy cautioned. She pronounced nonchalant the French way, without sounding the T. Later, they sat on the fender of a parked car in front of the store. From their vantage point, they could see the row of shopping carts. Every now and then, a shopper would notice the carts and stare curiously for a while, as if looking for a sign to explain their presence. One woman lifted a bunch of celery from one cart and placed it in hers. After a while, there was a flurry of activity from the clerks. Two of them had discovered the carts and stood there, hands on their hips, puzzled. Within a few minutes, 5 or 6 other clerks were looking at the carts, puzzled, mystified, scratching their heads, looking around suspiciously. The manager finally arrived, a small, bald, harassed-looking man. He exploded with fury. He waved his arms. He jumped up and down like a figure in a cartoon. The sheepish clerks began to move the carts away. All of it delighted Amy. Her laughter was marvelous to hear. "We did it, Ace," she said. "We did it." That night, when he took her home, he kissed her for the first time. She was the first girl he had ever kissed, and he swelled with a love and desire that caused his body to tremble.
Is Amy Hertz one of the clues?
I think so. But I wanted to keep her separate from everything else, especially after she phoned me that afternoon.
Phoned you?
Yes. I had told her when we first met that I had lived in Monument since I was 4 years old, that my family had moved to New England from a small town in Pennsylvania, Rawlings, Pennsylvania. Then, one day...
Amy's voice was vibrant on the telephone.
"Are you busy, Ace?"
"No. What's going on?"
A call from Amy was always exciting. Sometimes she had an idea for a new number. Like going to the Holiday Inn early in the morning and ghosting through the corridors, removing the Do Not Disturb signs from the doorknobs. Or turning them to the side that said, in 3 languages, "Please make up our room early." Sometimes she only wanted to talk. She'd tell him the entire plot of a movie she'd just seen on television. Other times she'd say, "Talk to me. Read me poetry." His voice quivering, he would read her a poem he had written, pretending it was the work of an obscure poet. "My love for you is like a searching wind." But this call was different.
"Look, Ace," she said, "I'm at the newspaper. I dropped in to see my father, and he has a visitor. An editor from Rawlings, Pennsylvania, who was passing through and decided to drop in for a visit. Isn't Rawlings where you're from?"
Once again, Adam was swept with a series of vivid impressions. The bus ride at night. The sense of hurry. Amy went on.
"Listen, this guy says he's lived in Rawlings all his life and he can't remember any farmers there. Not farmers, but your kind of farmer. He says he's always known everybody in town. Didn't you say your father sold insurance in Rawlings?
I don't know, Adam said. Why is it important?
Well, it's not important, really. This man's just visiting, and when my father told him your family was also from Rawlings, he thought he'd drop in and see your folks. Kind of like a reunion. Then he couldn't remember any farmers ever being in Rawlings. Not in the insurance business, and I figured I'd call to check. I thought you'd be curious about your old hometown.
I am curious, Adam said. But he was more puzzled than curious. He tried to sound cool. He didn't want Amy to hear the puzzlement in his voice.
Well, how about your mother? What was her maiden name? Maybe he remembers your mother.
Amy giggled.
Some men are like that.
My mother's name was Holden. Louise Holden.
Hold on. I'll see if it strikes sparks.
He heard muffled conversation as Amy apparently reported her findings to the visiting editor.
Nope, Amy said, returning to the phone. That doesn't ring a bell either.
Hey, how long did you live there, anyway? Didn't you say you were born there?
Adam was about to say, I was born there, and my parents were too. But something made him remain silent. The memory of flight.
You still there, Ace?
Look, Amy, I said we came to Monument from Rawlings, but I didn't say I was born there.
You must have misunderstood.
We lived there, oh, only a few months, I guess. And my father wasn't working during that time. He'd had an accident, hurt his leg. We came to Monument when we heard that there was an insurance agency for sale.
Adam was amazed at his ability to lie, the way his mind had been quick to invent a new set of circumstances for himself and his parents. But he wondered, why? Why is it necessary to lie?
Well, I figured it was something like that, Ace. Anyway, too bad. If Rawlings had been your old hometown, your father and mother might have enjoyed meeting him. They could have had a reunion and all. Well, thanks anyway, Amy. I appreciate it.
Was that all?
Yes.
Did Amy ever mention that conversation again?
No, never.
What did you think of the conversation and her questions?
I felt funny. Strange.
5-second interval.
Then I rationalized. I told myself that the editor from Rawlings had been mistaken. He probably had a bad memory. And I guess I tried not to think about it.
10-second interval. Then we've arrived at the second landmark, haven't we?
Have we?
Permit me to summarize. The first landmark was that day in the woods with the dog. The important thing was, what drove you and your father into the woods? The second landmark was that call from Amy. You were 9 years old at the first landmark, and 14 at the second.
I'm tired.
It's early. Take your time. We're doing so well.
I don't want to talk anymore.
You're thinking of Amy?
Yes.
Is it beginning to come back to you, all of it? Not only Amy?
I don't know.
Let it come. Remember, I'm here to help you. But let it come. The medicine will help, and I will help. But
it's up to me, isn't it? Whether I win or whether I lose?
Think about winning.
But if I lose?
Don't think about that. Don't think about that.
Would losing be that terrible?
5-second interval. Let us suspend for now.
Thank you.
End tape OZK-005.
The rain begins without warning, slashing at my face, pelting my body. Clouds had gathered as I pedaled along toward Carver, but they hadn't concerned me because the sun and the clouds had played disappearing games since my departure this morning. Then a sudden torrent greets me as I pump along a narrow section of Route 119. Mud kicks at my legs because the front tire has no fender, nothing to prevent the mud from splashing. The rain slants toward me and the bicycle. I am driving into the storm. I draw up at the side of the highway and ponder the situation. Squinting, I see a house about a quarter of a mile away, but I don't want to get mixed up with people. Trees offer the only shelter, and I push my bike toward a large maple, heavy with branches. The rain showers leaves down as I approach, and I realize the tree won't offer much protection,
because most of the leaves have already fallen. I lean against the tree trunk in disgust. The rain is really coming down now, in wavering sheets, tossed by the wind. The cold enters my clothes, seeps into my skin and into my bones. My father's package is soaked, and the roadmap is ruined. I pull my father's package off the bike and hug it to me, slipping it inside the jacket. The package is wet, but I don't mind. The rain continues. I watch the map dissolving. And I am suddenly hungry, ravenous. I am starved. I can't ever remember being as hungry as this. A car passes, a station wagon with wooden panels, and the driver looks back as if he might stop. But he doesn't. I wish he had stopped. I could have thrown the bike into the back of the car and driven along warm and dry inside. But I'm also glad that he didn't stop. "You are a nut," I tell myself, my voice sounding strange in my ears. The rain dances on the ground, the way water jumps and leaps if you drop it on a hot stove. I shrivel into myself, hugging myself, cold and damp and miserable. I am not damp. I am drenched. "I'm going back," I yell. "No, you're not," I answer. My voice is lost in the wind and the rain. All right, I am going to Rutterburg, Vermont," I sing out, lifting my voice above the sound of the rain. A rumble of thunder answers me. The gods are listening, and I press my back against the tree, and I feel stronger suddenly, as if I am part of it all, part of the tree and part of the storm, part of the thunder and part of the rain. I lift my face and the rain pours down, and I begin to sing. "The farmer in the dell, the farmer in the dell."
Tape OZK006, 1830, date deleted, TA. So, we've arrived at the point where your suspicions were aroused.
I don't remember arriving at that point.
Are you playing games?
No. Why should I play games? I'm on the edge of panic half the time. Why should I play games?
5-second interval. Forgive me. If I seem abrupt, critical, it's only for your sake.
I know.
7-second interval. Let me refresh your memory. At the last meeting, you mentioned the telephone call from Amy from her father's office, the visiting editor from Rawlings. Did that arouse your suspicions?
It made me feel funny.
How do you mean, funny?
Well, what Amy said about there being no farmers, no farmer family in Rawlings. And even the way I had tried to cover up, as if I had to cover up instinctively, as if I knew something was wrong.
And what did you think was wrong?
I don't know.
Did you think your father had been lying to you all that time? That you and your family didn't come from Rawlings?
No. I couldn't allow myself to think that. And yet I kept getting these funny feelings, remembering that night we ran away. That seemed to be mixed up with it all.
Did you confront your father?
No, I couldn't do that. But I felt that I could probably find out some other way.
What other way?
Oh, it was vague. Maybe look in old picture albums, old papers and letters, for some proof that we actually lived in Rawlings, that I'd been born there. And yet it wasn't that pressing. I mean, I wasn't really in a panic.
It didn't bother you too much then?
Yes, it did. But only when I took the time to think about it. I was busy with school, with Amy and her numbers.
You didn't mention the visiting editor and your doubts about Rawlings to your mother or father?
No.
That seems like the most natural course you could have taken.
Maybe. But I didn't want to.
8-second interval. But you finally did something about it, didn't you?
Did I?
5-second interval. Yes, because otherwise we wouldn't be sitting here talking about it, would we? You wouldn't have brought up Amy's telephone call at all, would you have?
I guess not.
So tell me, what did you do about it? 5-second interval. Tell me.
I can't remember exactly.
15-second interval.
But of course, he did remember finally. It was all clear and lucid now. Unforgettable. He knew that his father kept his private and official papers in the bottom drawer of the desk in the den. An insurance agent required a desk at home, where he could fill out the never-ending series of reports and keep the documents and other paraphernalia of his trade. Adam knew that the bottom drawer contained certain certificates that were taken out only on special occasions, like the time he needed a birth certificate to show that he was old enough to join the Boy Scouts. Adam dropped out after a few meetings. He wasn't interested in standing at attention, tying knots, or going on hikes. Ordinarily, his father locked the drawer. The key hung on his keychain, along with the house keys and the car keys and some others. His father always tossed the chain casually on an end table near the front door when he came into the house. Adam waited for his opportunity. Actually, he was barely conscious of his desire to check the bottom drawer. He had become convinced that the visiting editor had made a mistake. Amy had never mentioned his visit again. Looking at his father in his proper suit and tie, Adam was ashamed of his suspicions. In fact, what suspicions, really? And yet, that day, when he saw the keychain on the table, and knowing that his father was out mowing the lawn, Adam knew that he would look into the bottom drawer. He picked up the keychain. The keys were cool to his touch. He could hear the lawnmower at the far end of the front lawn. Perfect. His mother was upstairs. She was always upstairs these days. She came down to prepare the meals and do the housework, but increasingly she stayed in her room. At any rate, his father's desk was located in a spot from which he could observe the steps going upstairs. Keeping his mind blank and his motives muffled, Adam walked to the desk, inserted the small key into the drawer lock, turned it, and pulled the drawer open. The drawer contained a dozen or so brown envelopes. Adam lifted out a few. The envelopes were identified with his father's familiar scrawl. Mortgage, U.S. Treasury bonds, New England Tell and Tell stocks, birth certificates. He opened this last envelope and took out the 3 crisp sheets of paper inside. They were official-looking, a blue seal at the bottom, signed by Tobias Simpson, town clerk, Rawlings, Pennsylvania. Adam inspected the certificate that bore his name. Adam David Farmer. "We gave you my name as your middle name," his father had explained long ago, because 2 Davids would confuse everyone. Adam inspected the certificate, and it all checked out. His birthday, February 14th, Valentine's Day. His mother was sentimental about birthdays, and Adam's in particular. She shopped for days and always baked a special cake. "A lovely day to be born, Adam, a day of love and tenderness," she said. He looked at his father's and mother's birth certificates. Same official-looking paper, same signature, Tobias Simpson, town clerk. Adam flicked through the other envelopes. Insurance policies, social security cards. He looked at his card and his number. It was new-looking, fresh, untouched. Why would someone his age need a social security number? Suspicion made him pause, and in that pause, the sound of the lawnmower grew louder, and Adam held his breath. The lawnmower's motor receded, and Adam exhaled. He remembered that you needed a social security number to open a bank account, and his parents had presented him with his own bank book and $50 deposited in his name on his 10th birthday. There was only one envelope left in the drawer. It was sealed. Adam held it in his hand,
the envelope almost weightless. He knew that he could not risk opening it. He also knew that it probably contained nothing suspicious at all. In fact, he felt ridiculous and guilty investigating the contents of the drawer. Still curious, he held the envelope up to the light and could see faint outlines of a document inside. The document looked familiar, the blue seal at the bottom. He realized that the envelope contained another birth certificate or something similar. The blue seal was identical to the seal on the other birth certificates. Why another certificate? Had someone else been born that he knew nothing about? Did he have an unknown brother or sister, maybe? This was crazy. This was ridiculous. It could all be explained easily. But he had to open this envelope. He had to find out. He had to know. He inspected the envelope. Plain, white, undistinguished. Like any other envelope he'd often seen on his father's desk. He searched the desk now, opening drawers, and came upon a bunch of white envelopes. He compared them with the sealed envelopes. They were the same. It would be easy. The sound of the power mower suddenly died. An emptiness filled the air. Adam was too much committed to his search to stop now. Even though his father might be heading for the house for a glass of beer or to rest a while, he quickly tore open the sealed envelope and withdrew the certificate. It was a birth certificate, all right. Signed and sealed by the same Tobias Simpson, town clerk, Rawlings, Pennsylvania. At first, Adam thought the certificate was a duplicate of his own, because his name was written on the paper. Adam David Farmer. But the date was different. This date was July 14th. The year was correct, exactly as it appeared on the first birth certificate. But a different date. A different birthday. He had two birth certificates. Two birthdays. Crazily, he thought, was I born twice? And his hands began to tremble so badly that he could barely slip the certificate back into an envelope. His tongue was dry when he tried to lick the envelope. His hands shook as he replaced all the stuff in the drawer, turned the key in the lock, slipped the torn envelope into his pocket. He heard his father's footsteps at the back door as he returned the keys to the table. He went downstairs and hid in the cellar until the trembling stopped.
And what did you do about it?
Nothing. There was nothing I could do. I figured it was a mistake. I figured that when we left Rawlings, my father had arranged for the birth certificates to be made out. We'd need them wherever we were going. And that the town clerk, that Tobias Simpson, had made a mistake and given him the wrong one or something. Wrote down the wrong date. And probably my father didn't notice it until later and had to send it back for the right one.
But why this reaction of yours? You trembled, you shook, you had the shivers. You hid in the cellar. 8-second interval.
That was my first reaction. Later, I got myself under control and tried to be reasonable about it all. There had to be a simple explanation. But...
But what?
But I wondered. Why did he keep the birth certificate if it was wrong, had the wrong date? And why did he keep it sealed?
What did you do about it? 5-second interval.
I'm tired. I've got a headache.
What did you do about it?
It's late. I want to go to bed.
What did you do about it?
I can't remember. It's too hazy.
What did you do about it? 6-second interval.
Nothing. But he did do something. He became a spy. A secret agent in his own home. Listening at doorways, eavesdropping on telephone conversations, watchful and wary and suspicious. "What's the matter? Don't you feel well?" his mother asked. She was always solicitous about him, concerned and worried, emerging from her sad cocoon to fuss over him. "I'm all right, Mom," he answered. But he would study his mother,
even though she was so sweet and innocent that he felt guilty for his doubts. He wondered what secrets she harbored, what dark knowledge she kept hidden within her. Is this what made her sad? What kept her in her room during the day, closeted in the house all the time, seldom venturing into the outside world? And his father? What about his father? In his proper clothes, his suit and vest, his morning newspaper, what secrets lurked in him? Or am I dramatizing? Adam wondered. He wanted to be a writer, to capture drama on paper. Was he really manufacturing mysteries to satisfy his literary longings, finding mysteries where they did not in fact exist? Although Amy was the most important person in his life, he couldn't bring himself to talk to her about the doubts that tormented him. He was afraid she would laugh. He was afraid to lessen himself in her eyes. She had brought brightness and gaiety to his life, and he didn't want to risk losing it all. That's why he submitted to the numbers, accompanying her on those heady and hilarious but somehow terrible trips to the A&P and the Holiday Inn. When he thought of telling her what was bothering him and anticipating her reaction, Amy, who never took anything seriously, he drew back and remained silent. A tortured silence. And he continued to spy, to probe, to watch.
And what did you find out, finally?
Too much, and not enough.
Do you really believe that, or are you merely being clever? 5-second interval. I'm sorry to be so blunt. Please explain what you mean.
I wasn't trying to be a wise guy. I was telling the truth. I found out, for instance, about my mother's Thursday night telephone calls. And when I realized what the calls were about, it was both too much and not enough. It was worse than just knowing about the birth certificates.
Tell me about the telephone calls. 10-second interval.
I have a feeling you already know about them. I have a feeling you know everything, even my blank spots.
Then why should I make you go through it all? Why should I carry on this charade?
I don't know.
You disappoint me. Can't you think of the one person who will benefit? 5-second interval.
Me. That's what you said at the beginning, but I never asked for it. I never asked to benefit by it.
4-second interval.
I have a headache.
Don't retreat now. Don't retreat. Tell me about the phone calls your mother made. 5-second interval.
There really isn't very much to tell.
Actually, there was a lot to tell. But he didn't want to speak anymore. He wanted only to say the minimum, to say the words that would satisfy Brent and then go back to his room to rest and relax. He didn't want to pick up the burden of remembering any longer. He wanted to coast a while, float, not let it matter, drift. This is why he hated Brent sometimes, because he interrupted the sweet drifting with his questions. His incessant, never-ending questions.
Tell me what there is to tell, whether it's very much or not.
I don't know if I want to talk about the call.
And yet, there was something good in the talking, in the discoveries. He had learned that the talking was discovery. Words would come to his tongue that he had not known were lying in wait for him. The facts of his life would appear the moment he told them. The empty spaces were filled, the terrifying blankness that loomed before him sometimes at night in the darkness, and he'd wake up not knowing who he was or where he was. In the talking, the blank spots were filled in.
What about your mother and the telephone calls?
Calls were made every Thursday.
Adam had been aware of the calls, and not aware of them.
He knew that Thursdays were his mother's best days. She was usually downstairs waiting for him when he got home from school. There was always the aroma of newly baked cookies or cake in the kitchen. Something chocolate. Adam loved chocolate. And on Thursdays, his mother prepared a chocolate treat for him and watched with pleasure as he wolfed it down. Sometimes she hummed or sang as she worked around the house, dusting or mopping up. Early in the evening on Thursdays, she would disappear into the bedroom, closing the door behind her. Adam was cautioned not to use the telephone at that hour. "Your mother's special telephone hour," his father explained a long time ago. Adam had accepted the explanation without question, and the telephone hour became part of the fabric of the household. He figured that his mother had set aside this time of day to complete all her calls to friends. But what friends? To relatives. They had no living relatives, his father had informed him with regret a long time ago. Her committee women. His mother was too shy and withdrawn to be active in social or civic affairs. And yet the telephone hour had gone on for so long a time that Adam had never really questioned its purpose or reason. It belonged to the world of adults, and adults often did things, sometimes ridiculous, sometimes beyond comprehension, but they were allowed to do them simply because they were adults. They needed no other reason. His suspicions roused by the two birth certificates and the tantalizing problem they presented, Adam began to question the familiar, everyday events of his life and the comings and goings of his mother and father. He watched for telltale clues, any remark or action that could not be explained. He listened avidly for any mention of Rawlings, Pennsylvania. None. The routine of their lives went on without incident, and Adam told himself that he was looking for trouble where none existed. He told himself that both the birth certificates and the strange stuff about Rawlings could be explained away. One Thursday evening, his mother excused herself as usual and went upstairs to the bedroom, closing the door. His father went downstairs to the cellar. He had transformed part of the cellar into a combination recreation room and office, pine-paneled with some office paraphernalia, plus a ping-pong table and a television set. He and his father played ping-pong occasionally, but most of the time his father used the room for business purposes, writing reports and policies there, and meeting once in a while with businessmen or insurance company officials. On that particular Thursday, with his mother upstairs and his father downstairs, Adam spotted the extension telephone hanging on the wall of the den. He drew a sharp breath. Holding the breath, he made his way across the room like a sleepwalker. He placed his hand on the telephone. The instrument was cool to his touch, and the coolness established reality, the reality of what he was about to do, eavesdrop on his mother. He thought of Amy's belief in mischief. He exhaled, letting the air seep out of his mouth, and then picked up the receiver, slowly, painstakingly. He heard a voice he did not recognize. A soft voice, cultured. More than cultured. Detached, as if speaking from far away. Not far away in distance, but in something else. A woman's voice. "It's beautiful here, Louise. This is the loveliest time of the year." Then his mother's voice. "It must be so peaceful there, Martha. So safe, so secure." "But it's not a retreat from the world," the voice answered, a gentle admonishment in the words. "It's not simply a place to hide, Louise. You know that. Otherwise, there would be no point in being here, would there?" Of course," his mother said. "Only when I think of all that's happened, I envy you, Martha." "Enough of that, enough." The gentle chiding was there again. Although the woman's voice didn't disclose any evidence of great age, she spoke to Adam's mother as if she were much older and his mother a child. "And now tell me, Louise, about Adam. How's my fine nephew doing? What has he been up to this week?" That word hung in the air, isolated from the others. Nephew.
and superimposed on the voice was his father's voice saying a long time ago, "We're alone in the world, Adam. You and your mother and me. That's why you've got to grow up strong and brave and good. You're the last of the line."